We're going to talk right now on this portion of Vocal Point about Christmas celebrations through the centuries, or where did we get some of these main celebrations that we even use today? Our guest is Dr. Timothy Paul Jones, timothypauljones.com. He's a seminary professor at the flagship seminary of the Southern Baptist denomination. He's the author and then also the speaker for a video series, but he's the author of a book called Christian History Made Easy. I've been watching the video series and been getting a lot out of it. And Dr. Jones, it's so great to have you back on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you again.
Okay, great. Let's get right to it. First of all, did the early church celebrate the birth of Jesus? And where does the December 25th date come? And you don't have to go into too much details on that one.
Right. The early church did not celebrate the birth date of Jesus. They did not probably know when it was that Jesus was born. In fact, we don't really see it being celebrated around December 25th until sometime in the 4th century. Most likely there were some backgrounds of a midwinter celebration, and that ended up getting tied in with and was seen to be at that time a convenient time to celebrate the birth of Jesus. But it wasn't based on any knowledge that this is when Jesus was actually born. It was rather based on a traditional celebration being used at that time.
Okay, but when you say 300s, in some ways, you said the 4th century, which is the 300s. In some ways, that's pretty close to the beginning, you know, compared to, say, you know, 1972 or something like that.
Certainly, it was something that is very venerable. It's part of the church's tradition for a long time. And even before that time, there seemed to have been some interest in celebrating the birth of Jesus, but not at a particular date or a particular time or anything like that.
Okay. Where does the nativity scene come from? I understand it comes from St. Francis of Assisi.
There was. It seems that from sometime at least in that era, it may have been that he actually came up with it, more likely popularized that, but some sort of a nativity scene or something where reenacting that in a way. Probably a lot of that had to do with the same reason we have Bible stories being told in stained glass windows in many of the churches of the Middle Ages. It was because people couldn't read, and so by enacting something like that or by putting it in art, they were able to express to common people who couldn't read the capacity to understand and to experience this story for themselves.
Okay, St. Nicholas was a real person, and obviously from his name is derived Santa Claus. Comment on the real St. Nicholas.
Well, it is a fascinating story and one of my favorites, I will admit. It's a man from the region today that we know as Turkey. It was Nicholas of Myra. Well, Nicholas of Myra, he was born probably somewhere around 280, so late 3rd century is when he was born. And he was persecuted, and he was put in prison for his faith in Jesus Christ. Remember, at that time, the Christian faith was still illegal in the Roman Empire, and he endured some of the worst eras of persecution during Galerius and Diocletian. Well, he comes out of prison at one point, bloodstained, streaked, all of that, and people cry out, Nicholas confessors, kind of identifying him as somebody who had confessed the faith all the way through times of suffering. And there's one legend that emerges later. We don't know for certain if it's true or not, but there is an early legend in which St. Nicholas was at the Council of Nicaea. And you remember the Council of Nicaea is when Christians were brought together from all over the Roman Empire. They did not determine who Jesus was. They did not decide the Trinity. They did not decide the canon. What they were coming together to do is to respond to a guy named Arius who had denied the eternal sonship and the eternal deity of Jesus Christ, and they were coming together to express what was already the consensus of the church at that time. Well, they came together, and if this legend is correct, what happens is that Nicholas has an encounter with Arius, this heretic, and ends up slapping him across the face in the midst of the Council of Nicaea. Now, as I said, we don't know for certain that that's correct, and also according to the same story, he was disciplined by the council for that, but we do know this. Nicholas was somebody who stood strong for orthodox truth about Jesus and about the Trinity all the way to the 3rd and 4th centuries. We know that for absolute certain, and there's a couple of later legends that kind of play into some things to do with Nicholas. One of them is that people are at least a little bit familiar with sometimes is that he provided 3 bags of gold as dowry for some girls. So there's some gift giving, whose father was very poor, this idea of gift giving. There's also an idea of Nicholas's interest in children. This is a very late tradition. It almost certainly has no basis in reality, but it was very popular during the Middle Ages. And here's the tradition that an innkeeper killed 3 young boys and pickled them in barrels in his basement. And Nicholas kind of becomes a detective and discovers this. Now, as I said, that didn't happen. There's no reason to think it did happen, but it does help us understand how St. Nicholas gets tied with gift-giving and with children. It helps us understand that, well, his feast day is December 6th, and so that feast day in the Middle Ages, 1200 to 1400 particular, in the later part of the Middle Ages, becomes a very popular time for gift-giving in memorial of or remembering St. Nicholas.
Huh. Mainly because of the gift giving to the father with the 3 daughters or whatever?
Yes, it seems that that's kind of comes from that tradition, and that gets tied to St. Nicholas and then ends up in December because his feast day is already in December, December 6th being the feast day of St. Nicholas of Myra.
Wow. Okay, what else do you want to say about the Middle Ages beyond St. Nicholas and beyond St. Francis of Assisi as far as the Middle Ages and Christmas?
Well, it's pretty fascinating that we have in the later part of the Middle Ages, the early part of the Reformation, sort of this transition in which the gift-giving ends up moving from December 6th to Christmas time. Christmas time was in the Middle Ages a time of feasting. The 12 days of Christmas from December 24th to January 6th, that is from the celebration of Christ's birth all the way to the celebration of the coming of the wise men, which is sometimes called Epiphany, on January 6th. That was a time of feasting. Well, something we start to see happening 1400s through the 1600s is those kind of meld together at Christmas time, and so the legend of St. Nicholas ends up kind of moving later in the month, we might say, and the gift giving starts to be identified with Christmas time during that time.
It's my understanding, in fact, one of the things I really enjoyed in your tape series and so forth is it's important for us to understand about the eastern half of Christendom and its break with the western half of Christendom, and this is all before Protestantism even arose. So you're talking about, in other words, the Roman Catholic Church and then the Orthodox Church in all of its different venues. So if I understand things correctly, the Orthodox to this day will celebrate Christmas around that time of Epiphany in early January, whereas both the Catholics and the Protestants will celebrate Christmas as December 25th. And then they had a conference, or a council rather, to try and reconcile these things, and the best they could do is come up with the 12 days of Christmas, which is the 12 days between those two dates on the calendar.
Right, that's at least part of it. There's a little bit, there's some more complexities to it to do with the East and the West and all of that. But yeah, the Eastern Orthodox Church to this day focuses much, much more heavily on that latter part toward January 6th than toward the earlier part, which is much more characteristic of Western Christianity, of Roman Catholicism. And then some parts have even carried into Protestantism in the ways that we celebrate it today, as well as just in Western culture as a whole.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, though. In some ways, there's something to be said for the Orthodox idea in this. The Epiphany is celebrating the coming of the wise men, right? The Magi?
Right.
And the reason I bring that up is because the gold and frankincense and myrrh, those would be technically the first material type of gifts given. These were the original Christmas gifts, other than, say, God gave us his son, which would be the ultimate Christmas gift. But in terms of material possessions being given as a gift from one person to another, it's the wise men. So I can understand that Epiphany, as a main celebration day for Christmas. I mean, it makes sense.
Oh, yes, definitely. There's a lot of things about it. I've often jokingly said, if I had my way of doing things, we would celebrate Advent and have only Advent music, which there's not much Advent music out there, all the way up until December 24th, and then we would celebrate these over the 12 days, kind of spread out Christmas over that. And the reason I think that's actually a good thing to think about, and in our house, we actually do still celebrate Epiphany in our our household will have a celebration of that. And but I think it's important because it also sets us on mission, because the point of Epiphany is that the gospel goes to those who are not Jewish, those who come from afar. And that's the reason I celebrate it in our household, is I want our children to think of that.
Yeah. And but I mean, you think about this. You just think about the millions of gifts that are going to be exchanged at Christmas time this year. And, you know, every year, I mean, millions upon millions upon millions. And it all gets back to those magi bearing, you know, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Okay, Martin Luther and Christmas. Tell us what you know.
Well, one of the things that's important to understand about Martin Luther is his kind of movement of Christmas to a family celebration. And he's often credited, not quite correctly, with the invention of the Christmas tree. The Christmas tree was already in existence before Martin Luther's times. There's a couple of different places we know that it existed, probably because there was a medieval tradition that at the birth of Jesus, all the trees, their leaves sprouted anew. They shook off their snow and leaves sprouted anew. That's a medieval legend, medieval tradition, but probably that there's some connection there to that. But what it does seem that Martin Luther may have contributed to was certainly the popularization of a family Christmas celebration, perhaps with a Christmas tree. And it does seem that he may have been the one who first spoke of in a clearly and was talking about putting lights on it. Of course, in his time, it was candles. And I've often jokingly said one day Martin Luther invented this idea of the Christmas tree with candles, and the next day they invented the first fire department. That doesn't sound like a very safe thing.
Yeah.
But certainly Martin Luther had something to do with it. But this idea of this family celebration of gift giving at Christmas time was certainly something that Martin Luther shaped as part of Martin Luther's overall interest in making certain that the story of Jesus is passed on to our children and seeing the home as a context for discipleship. This was very much for Luther part of that overall emphasis that he has that undergirds so much of his life and ministry.
I heard recently a speech where somebody was saying that the first Christmas tree or the first Christmas trees in America came from Germans. And, you know, that would make sense in terms of Martin Luther and his influence. But also, what about Kris Kringle? Is that related to Martin Luther? And I understand that stands ultimately for the Christ child.
Right. It's not directly, it's more of a something Germanic in origins, but to the best of my knowledge anyway, that's not something directly from Martin Luther, but it certainly makes sense deriving that from Germany. It certainly seems so. And also Latvia, Strasbourg, I know that there are certain evidences from the 15th and 16th centuries of Christmas trees being used in some of those areas as well that would have certainly come over to the United States, or the colonies, I guess I should say, would have come over to the colonies. The idea of that, at least. Although early on in the colonies, the Separatists, the Puritans, actually outlawed Christmas, and much of our popularity of the Christmas tree actually probably traces largely back to the 1840s, when there was in the London newspaper, there was a picture published that was widely distributed of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, who were very popular at that mm-hmm. time, with their family around a Christmas tree. And probably that 1840s is the way we use and celebrate the Christmas tree probably the point at which it begins to get popularized in the way that we know it today.
There's a lot of positive aspects about the Puritans. I wouldn't agree with them on this point about Christmas. What was their problem with Christmas?
Well, it's important to recognize it wasn't just because they were trying to be killjoys or something like that, and that's often the image that's given. We've got to understand that by the 1600s and especially by the 1700s, Christmas had become a rowdy and even violent time drunkenness, of overindulgence, and so that was their experience of what Christmas was. And so when you understand it that way, you understand their outlawing of a Christmas. And in fact, in the 1800s, much of what we see of Christmas coming into the 1800s is this the reason that people like Washington Irving were trying to kind of emphasize Santa Claus and Christmas and everything like that was because they were trying to turn it back into or to turn it into a domesticated home and family holiday, basically to reduce this kind of spectacle that Christmas had turned into. And it's very clear that especially in the 1700s and to some degree in the 1600s, Christmas Christmas was more like what we would think of as New Year's Eve at its worst.
Think about
New Year's Eve at its worst. That's what Christmas was in the 1700s in particular. And if you start thinking about that heritage in the 1600s, 1700s, you start to understand why the Puritans were wanting to separate themselves and the Separatists to separate themselves from this, and to have something that is focused on Christ at that time. And we have clear evidence of that 19th century, which is they're trying to recover Christmas, but they're trying to do it by moving it into something that is safe and domesticated and giving gifts and families and all of those things like that.
Right. All right. Well, listen, Merry Christmas to you. And let me give you the website again, TimothyPaulJones.com, the wonderful book and video series. Is called Christian History Made Easy. Thank you, Dr. Jones. Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you, and to you as well.
Okay, bye-bye.